This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. When was the last time you heard about a politician who realized he needed to change to help the country? That former ways had to be put aside to foster bipartisan cooperation for the good of the country. Well, you're about to hear about one, a U.S. Senator from Michigan, Arthur Vandenberg. There's a new biography out about him. Its author is Hank Meyer, and he joins us now. The subtitle of your book is The Man in the Middle of the American Century. In what way was Arthur Vandenberg in the middle of the American century?
Well, Lester, he really symbolized in many ways the changing role of the United States in the world. He had gone from being an isolationist before World War II and coming out of World War I saying, we've got to stay out of other people's wars and let's not put our boys in harm's way in Europe. Let's be neutral when these new wars were going to break out. And this is at a time when Hitler was coming to power and Mussolini and the Japanese are invading Manchuria. And then after the war, he came to recognize that America was the global undisputed superpower, that we had responsibilities to lead in the world, and that it was both in our interests and in the interest of world peace for the U.S. to take a leading role in forming the United Nations and in helping rebuild Europe through the Marshall Plan, things like that.
I want to talk further about how he got there, but let's start first with where he grew up. Grand Rapids, early childhood, pretty comfortable, but then the economy went bust and the family business went with it. What effect did that have on a young Vandenberg?
This is a young man who at the age of 9 started helping support his family. He started a little delivery service between a shoe factory in downtown Grand Rapids and the railroad depot. And his father had a harness business, as you say, had been fairly prosperous. And then in the panic of 1893, an early depression, lost most of that business. So Arthur felt a real sense of responsibility, and he was a real go-getter. And so he was working all through school. He spent a year at the University of Michigan, then got a job as a reporter at the Grand Rapids Herald.
Right, and he quickly found himself leading the Grand Rapids Herald fairly shortly after he was there. I mean, a few years I'm speaking about. It was a Republican newspaper. What was it about him that led to such success so early in life?
This was a time when newspapers were, I don't want to say the only source of news, but certainly the most important. And his was the Republican newspaper. Most papers were also partisan at the time in this rapidly growing city. And he was a young orator. He was a pretty good writer. And he became editor at 22. And he's writing editorials every day for the newspaper, sending them off to Republican leaders in Washington. And so 10 years later, at the end of World War I, he's influencing the League of Nations debate by supplying arguments to Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, who's fighting with Woodrow Wilson over the covenant of the League of Nations.
He was involved fairly deeply in Michigan politics, too, and finally was appointed to fill a vacancy in the U.S. Senate. How did he first make his mark in the Senate?
He first came there, in a way characteristic of his entire career, trying to build bridges. He came in just as Herbert Hoover became president in 1928, and Hoover was a brilliant engineer and administrator, but with no political experience. And the Republican Party, split as it often is, was split in those days between what was called the Old Guard, which was sort of the Eastern establishment, but very conservative, and the progressives, who tended to be Western politicians. And he came in trying to get them to work together with the president. They were both suspicious of Hoover. And so he went in trying to build bridges, but also first established his name with the early days of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. So the Depression comes in 1929, and in 1932 and 33, the economy is bottoming out. And in Detroit, in the first major city in the country, there was a banking crisis. The holding companies that owned the banks in Detroit were on the verge of collapse. And as a senator from Michigan, Vandenberg was trying to figure out how to rescue them and how to protect Michigan citizens and their savings deposits. And so he's negotiating the idea of deposit insurance, what became the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC. He brings that idea to Herbert Hoover and his Secretary of the Treasury. They don't want to have anything to do with it. This looks like a government bailout of the banks. And Vandenberg is saying, you know what, the only way we can restore confidence in our economy and in our banking system is if small depositors know that they can get their money out once they put it in. So then Franklin Roosevelt comes in. he goes to Roosevelt. He's been governor of New York, certainly no friend of Wall Street, but buying into the argument that strong banks shouldn't be trying to prop up weak ones, and so he doesn't want to have anything to do with deposit insurance. But Vandenberg lines up the votes in the Senate in a bipartisan way, and the FDIC is created. Turns out it's one of the most successful programs of the Depression, of the New Deal. Roosevelt later takes credit for it, but it was Arthur Vandenberg's baby.
Like any good writer, you found small stories that told big things about Vandenberg. There was a moment in the book that really struck me. It's 1932, depths of the Depression. A Michigan fruit grower named Adolph Belter came to Senator Vandenberg. His house had burned, and he brought in some charred rolls of money that he'd had stashed in a mason jar, presumably because no one trusted the banks at the time. The money was ruined, but Mr. Belter was hoping that Senator Vandenberg could somehow do something, anything for him. Tell us what happened.
Well, constituent service is an important part of a politician's job, and so he marched over to the Treasury Department with Adolph Belter, and they went to the people who work with the mint, and they have scientists who try to determine the origins of currency, and they were able to look at the charred remains of the farmers' dollar bills and figure out the denominations and were able to issue currency to help him. But you're right, that symbolized a time when people no longer trusted the banks. And so they're putting their money in mason jars, they're putting their money under the mattress, and there was no way the economy was going to get started again if that's what we felt we had to do to protect ourselves.
So as you mentioned, he didn't really like President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. He was an isolationist and against getting into another war in Europe. But this staunch Republican learned to work with Democrats to get things done during the biggest trial this nation has faced in its years. What's the lesson there for today's politicians?
He really viewed compromise not as something bad, but almost as an art form, as the way our democracy is supposed to work. Now, he learned that lesson painfully because Roosevelt was swept into office to fight the Depression, and the Republicans were tarred by the disaster of the Depression. And so by 1934, after that midterm election, there were only 17 Republicans in the Senate. So if you wanted to get anything done, whether it was deposit insurance or stopping some extravagant spending plan of the president's, and he was a good conservative, you had to work across the aisle. So he honed those skills out of necessity. But then when the big stuff came after World War II, and these were momentous decisions, do we join a United Nations? Do we commit ourselves to this massive aid program to rebuild the European democracies? Do we enter into an entangling alliance, which Vandenberg had always been loath to do because he was a follower of Alexander Hamilton, who advised George Washington not to do that, and then which became NATO? Those are things that shouldn't be done by one party. Those are committing the American people to major undertakings and sometimes sacrifices, and we've all got to do it together. And so he recognized that, and that really motivated him to reach across the aisle.
Vandenberg was well known in his time. He was mentioned in the same breath with names like Churchill and Roosevelt. He was well thought of. He was begrudgingly respected by his opponents, mentioned as a possible president in the future. Edward R. Murrow called him the central pivot of the entire era. How is it we don't know him better?
It's funny how some people can slip through the cracks of history. He was an editorial writer himself, had written short stories, had always wanted to write his own memoirs, but died of cancer while still in office and was unable to do that. He had two other would-be biographers. One was a reporter for the rival Grand Rapids Press who kept voluminous scrapbooks, was a Vandenberg contemporary, but didn't live to write anything. And then another biographer who had turned his dissertation at University of Michigan back in 1970 into the first of two volumes of Vandenberg, died before he could write the second volume. And the second volume really covers the most important years of Vandenberg's life. And so if you don't live to write the history and somebody else writes it from their point of view, it's awfully easy to be forgotten. And we tend to look at history in our modern age through presidential eras. And so if you're not president, unless you're some kind of notorious character, you tend to slip between the cracks of political history.
You mentioned FDIC, you mentioned NATO. What do you think his lasting legacies, his accomplishments that affect our lives, are today?
unquestionably, he was indispensable in helping with the Marshall Plan. When Europe was devastated after the war, and the most powerful military force in Europe was the Red Army, who now had swallowed up Poland and some of the other Eastern European countries, and Britain, France, the Netherlands, all these countries, their economies are crushed. President Truman had the good sense, knowing that we had to help them, to call his proposal the Marshall Plan, because General Marshall was revered and nonpartisan. Marshall said it could have been called the Vandenberg Plan, because Vandenberg really put it through. And that resurrected Western civilization to some extent, or was awfully important. And then on the heels of that came the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, that said, you know, we democracies have shared values, and we really need to be mutually assisting one another to protect ourselves, in this case, from the communist threat that had replaced the Nazi threat after World War II. Those are his big pieces of legislation. But more than that, I think, is the spirit of compromise that said, I am going to find a middle ground because that's where the interests of the American people ultimately lie. And he became a symbol so that now every time there is a foreign policy crisis of some kind and you have one party in the White House and the other party in Congress, somebody said, well, where is there a Vandenberg now? And so I think that symbol of how we want our government to work may be his most lasting legacy.
You've got a day job. Your time is in demand. You spent all this time writing this biography of Arthur Vandenberg. What was it that caught your attention that you wanted to commit yourself to that?
He was a local guy, and I had been in the newspaper business as well. I'd gone to the University of Michigan as well. I graduated from public high school in Grand Rapids as well, so I always felt a little commonality there and have always loved foreign policy and international politics. But beyond that, I got to have this sense of mission, that this was an important story that hadn't been told. And you could walk down the street 20 years ago in Grand Rapids and say, who was Arthur Vandenberg? And literally people would say, well, was he related to the jewelry store? Because there used to be a jewelry store of that name. No, he wasn't. But he, you know, he did some other things. There was a young man named Gerald Ford who got his start in politics with the endorsement of Arthur Vandenberg. And so he was this really major figure who was forgotten to a large degree in his own hometown and in his own home state, even as he was a major figure at a crucial time in our history on the world stage.
Hank Meyer is the author of the book Arthur Vandenberg, The Man in the Middle of the American Century. Mr. Meyer's day job is executive chairman of Meyer Incorporated. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
It's a pleasure, Lester. Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.